and chastity and other virtues will naturally unfold in our lives. Complete lifelong continence is for those who have a special dedication to God, as did Christ's disciples. They were monks, and their master was training them to become teachers of men. Therefore, he used emphatic words to remind them that they must preserve continence in thought, word, and deed. They must root out every obstacle in their path, every craving in their minds, and renounce every object of temptation. But because Christ knew that his teaching of total renunciation would not be followed universally, he said in Matthew 19:11-12, "All men cannot receive this saying, save they to whom it is given. For there are some eunuchs which were so born from their mother's womb, and there are some eunuchs which were made eunuchs of men, and there be eunuchs which have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He that is able to receive it, let him receive it." Lust is in the mind, and must be overcome by controlling the mind, but not in a negative way. Thinking lustful thoughts while outwardly observing continence is not self-control. It is nothing but repression. Nor will whipping oneself purify the mind. It only weakens the body. True self-mastery or inner control is gained only if men make themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. If they practice continence because they know worldly pleasures to be tasteless and empty compared to the joy of God. Again, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, "Thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths." But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great King. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be, yea, yea, nay, nay. For whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. Sri Ramakrishna used to say that God laughs on two occasions. He laughs when two brothers divide land between them, asserting, "This side belongs to me, and that side to you." God laughs, thinking to himself, "This whole universe is mine, and they say about one little lump of earth, 'This side belongs to me, and that side to you.'" God laughs again when the doctor says to the mother, weeping because of her child's severe illness, "Don't worry, I shall cure your child." The doctor does not realize that no one can save the child if God wills that it should die. Christ here is telling us the same thing. Although man cannot make one hair white or black, in his ignorance he thinks himself the doer. He asserts his ego, forgetting that the power he is using in every thought, in every action, is the power of God, and that it is God's heaven, God's throne, God's earth that he is trying to usurp. Christ therefore tells us, swear not at all, for when we swear, we assert the ego. Truly spiritual people never plan, "I will do this, I will do that." Having surrendered the ego to God, their first thought is, "If the Lord wills." Their humility stems from the realization that God and his power are working through us, that God is the doer and we are his instruments. This is an actual experience in the lives of saints. A holy man once told me that he lived for some time in a state of consciousness in which he vividly felt that each step he took was guided by the power of God. "Not I, not I, but thou, O Lord." The more we become established in this idea, the more we renounce the thought of self, the greater will be our attainment of peace. Chapter 3. Resist not evil. Matthew 5:38-47. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law, and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. Ye have heard that it hath been said, Thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. For if ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? And if ye salute your brethren only, what do ye more than others? Do not even the publicans so? The highest truth which has been taught by the great spiritual teachers of mankind is that we should love our enemies and not resist evil. Buddha, for instance, said, If a villainous bandit were to carve you limb from limb with a two-handled saw, even then the man that should give way to anger would not be obeying my teaching. Even then, be it your task to preserve your hearts unmoved, never to allow an ill word to pass your lips, but always to abide in compassion and goodwill, with no hate in your hearts, enfolding in radiant thoughts of love the bandit who tortures you, and proceeding thence to enfold the whole world in your radiant thoughts of love, thoughts great and beyond measure, in which there is no hatred or trace of harm. But although non-resistance has been preached in every great religion, it is a practice which most people find nearly impossible to understand and to follow. It is significant that Jesus, after teaching non-resistance, goes on to say, Be ye therefore perfect. In other words, to follow this truth in our own lives would lead us to perfection. And indeed, only he who is perfect, who has realized his union with God, who is able to see the divine existence in all beings, can turn the other cheek and live in universal love. For a man who has reached perfection, non-resistance is a spontaneous outpouring of his experience of God. Where is evil then? Who is an enemy then? We know instances of holy men who practiced non-resistance in our own age. Once my master, Swami Brahmananda, was practicing austere spiritual disciplines in Brindavan, a town associated with Sri Krishna's childhood. While he was sitting alone in meditation, a stranger came and laid a warm new blanket beside him. A few minutes later, another stranger came by and took the blanket away. Swami Brahmananda never moved. He smiled to himself, watching the divine play. Pavari Baba, a saint of 19th century India, one day surprised a thief in the act of stealing from his ashrama. The thief became frightened and ran away, dropping his bundle of stolen goods. The holy man took up the bundle, ran after the thief, laid the bundle at his feet, and with folded hands asked him to accept the goods. Free from any sense of ego or possession, Pavare Baba felt that everything belonged to God, and he actually saw God in all beings, even in the thief. The thief, incidentally, later became Pavare Baba's disciple. Perfect non-resistance is rare because few people struggle to achieve the lofty spiritual state which would enable them to practice it. There is a great variety in character and in levels of spiritual growth among mankind. Even if all men were afforded equal opportunities, which all too often they are not, they cannot grow and succeed in the same way and to the same extent, because their temperaments and tendencies differ. Variety and unity in variety make up the uniform law of creation. Take away variety and the world would end. The facts of birth and death and of life itself contradict any theory of equality and uniformity. All men deserve equal opportunities, no doubt. But when it comes to questions of good and evil, the differences between men must be taken into account. They must face situations differently. These differences pose serious problems in human conduct. In his article, The Religious Ground of Humanitarianism, Paul Elmer Moore tried to solve these problems by making a distinction between worldly and spiritual virtues. He said, "To apply the laws of the Spirit to the activities of this earth is at once a desecration and denial of religion, and a bewildering and unsettling of the social order." He declared, in effect, that as we meet those who are not inspired by religious virtues, we cannot, in our relations with them, practice virtues like humility and non-resistance in their highest form. Or if we did, the very structure of society would be undermined. In place of these, he would have us practice the Aristotelian or cardinal virtues of justice, temperance, prudence, and fortitude. Vedanta goes even further than Dr. Moore in recognizing ethical and behavioral differences. It's a fundamental belief in Vedanta that one reality, or God, dwells in the hearts of all beings. But God is not manifest equally in all beings, and all beings are not equally living in God. Vedanta consequently accepts the fact that human society has gradations.